Welcome to this continuing medical education audio podcast entitled Rapid Fire Review of CROI 2020 that provides a quick audio summary of the most essential data presented at CROI 2020. This independent CME activity is jointly provided by the Postgraduate Institute for Medicine and Viral Ed, Inc. Support for this program has been provided by an independent educational grant from Gilead Sciences Medical Affairs. This program is produced by the Postgraduate Institute for Medicine and Viral Ed, Inc. It is not a session created by or presented at CROI 2020, and it is not sanctioned by the organizers of CROI 2020. After completing this activity, the participant should be able to apply in a clinical setting the most current HIV prevention and treatment approaches and paradigms. Influence retention of patients on ARV therapy by addressing ARV side effects that can interfere with adherence to ARV regimens. Employ the rapid initiation of appropriate and effective antiretroviral therapy. Describe new antiretroviral agents in development and how they may be used in the treatment of people with HIV infection. Our distinguished faculty for this program includes Drs. Ian Frank from the University of Pennsylvania, Jose Arribas from the Hospital de La Paz, Jürgen Rockstra from the University of Bonn, Marta Buffito and Graham Moyle from Chelsea and Westminster Hospital, Paul Sachs from Harvard Medical School, and Renslo Scherer from the University of Chicago. The Postgraduate Institute for Medicine requires all faculty participating in this activity to disclose any real or apparent conflict of interest they may have as related to the content of this activity. All faculty disclosures can be reviewed here or on the homepage of this program. In support of improving patient care, this activity has been planned and implemented by the Postgraduate Institute for Medicine and Viral Ed, Inc. Postgraduate Institute for Medicine is jointly accredited by the American Council for Continuing Medical Education, ACCME, the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, ACPE, and the American Nurses Credentialing Center, ANCC, to provide continuing education for the healthcare team. Please refer to the program homepage for information on the specific amount of AMA PRA Category 1 credits offered for this activity. Thank you for your time. The podcast will now begin.
Hi, this is Ian Frank from the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome to this podcast. I am very quickly going to review with you some of the highlights in HIV prevention that were seen and discussed at the recent CROI 2020 conference, a virtual meeting. So first, let me talk about some updates in the DiSCOVER trial. This was a randomized trial that compared TAF-FTC and TDF-FTC for HIV prevention. We saw some data at 96 weeks, which showed continued non-inferiority of the TAF-FTC arm compared to individuals that received TDF-FTC. If you listen to Graham Moyle's podcast, he'll talk about some of the safety differences that were seen in this study. So now, FDA approval in the United States, two different options for PrEP among MSM and transgender women. What about the real-world adoption and utilization of PrEP? And we saw some interesting data at this conference. One cohort from British Columbia, a government-sponsored program that were able to enroll 4,459 individuals that started PrEP. These were mostly men who have sex with men, some intravenous drug users, a government program that was providing medication and all of the required testing free of charge. And over an 18-month period of time, we saw excellent retention rates, retention of about 76% of the cohort. Only 7 seroconversions were observed, all in individuals who had stopped PrEP. So in the past, we've seen a high dropout rate in PrEP programs, but this shows that when the medication is provided free of charge and testing is free, you can actually retain a very high proportion of your population. We also saw some interesting data looking at the effectiveness of PrEP in MSM and trans women who were either on PrEP or not on PrEP at the time of the diagnosis of a sexually transmitted infection. These were data from the STI clinic in King County, Washington State, or Seattle. These were individuals that were just followed in an observational analysis. And those individuals that were on PrEP had a 84% protection from HIV acquisition. There were five infections in individuals that were on PrEP at the time of the STI diagnosis, all of whom stopped their PrEP prior to becoming HIV infected, compared to 97 individuals diagnosed with HIV infection that were not on PrEP. Obviously, one of the risks of initiating PrEP in individuals who are newly infected is the risk for resistance. And we saw some interesting data from the Thai acute HIV infection cohort that demonstrated that the risk for developing HIV resistance on PrEP following the initiation of PrEP in the setting of acute HIV infection is related to how long you are on PrEP before that HIV infection is actually diagnosed. So there were seven individuals that were started on PrEP with acute HIV infection. Three individuals developed resistance, either an M184I or V mutation. None developed a K64R mutation. And these individuals had been on PrEP for 29 or more days, compared to four individuals that were on PrEP for 2 weeks or less prior to their diagnosis of acute HIV infection. So there may be some forgiveness if individuals are starting PrEP soon after their HIV diagnosis, although it should be pointed out that these individuals had a very low viral load when they were initiated on PrEP. And that may not be the same kind of situation if individuals have higher viral loads at the time of their acute HIV infection. So a reminder, check an HIV viral load in individuals who you're starting on PrEP who've had risk in the last 4 weeks. There was some data looking at a new urine tenofovir assay that may be implementable as a point of care test to determine whether or not individuals are adhering to their tenofovir as PrEP or perhaps as part of their HIV treatment regimen. This was a highly accurate test. A positive point of care test means that an individual has either taken a dose of their tenofovir within the last 24-hour period of time. If their test is negative, you can be pretty confident that the patient has not been on tenofovir or not taken their tenofovir for at least the past 120 hours. So let's talk about a new interesting PrEP product that was described at this conference. I'm talking about MB66, a vaginal film that had been infused with VRC01, a neutralizing monoclonal antibody against HIV, or HSV8. That's not Kaposi's sarcoma virus. That is an HSV2 neutralizing monoclonal antibody. In this PK analysis, women inserted this vaginal film daily for 7 days, and the level of antibody and its neutralizing capacity were analyzed. Women during that period of time achieved high levels of antibody, which were effective in neutralizing virus. And even after women stopped the insertion, investigators were able to identify neutralizing antibodies that persisted for 7 days after the last insert. So very new and interesting product. We saw at this conference some updates on post-exposure prophylaxis, three different animal studies that I'm going to describe. One, the use of bictegravir taf FTC as post-exposure prophylaxis. Animals either got that three-drug combination or two-drug combination, TAF FTC or a placebo. Animals that got the three-drug products were most likely to be protected, even though the animals may have received the PEP after 48 hours following the exposure to a SHIV challenge. In another study, islatravir was studied. Islatravir, a new nucleoside reverse transcriptase translocation inhibitor. Some animals got islatravir dosed weekly for 1 week, some for every 2 weeks, every 3 weeks, or four weekly doses. Animals that got two or more weekly doses were all protected from HIV, even though they may have been exposed to a SIV intravenous challenge. And the levels of islatravir that were obtained in these animals was lower than what we see with a weekly dose of islatravir in humans. The third study was a new vaginal insert with tenofovir and elvitegravir. In this analysis, the monkeys received a SHIV challenge and then had a placebo insert or this vaginal insert with active product inserted. The animals that got the active product were protected from SIV infection. We saw an important update on the HVTN-702 trial. This study was stopped by the Data Safety Monitoring Board, unfortunately, for futility. The study looked at a vaccine combination that was optimized in relationship to the RV744 trial. That was the Thai vaccine study that showed some protection. The vaccine products included Alvac HIV envelope glycoprotein together with GAG and PRO sequences, as well as a boost with a GP120 protein. Individuals that participated in the study had the active products given at month 0, 1, 3, 6, 12, and then a booster at week 18. And unfortunately, in neither men or women was there any evidence of protection. Fortunately, the women in the study had about a 3.5-fold increased risk of HIV acquisition compared to the men, but there was no benefit seen in the trial. Investigators are trying to understand why no benefit was seen in this study and some benefit was seen in the Thai study that I just alluded to. And then finally, let me review with you some data that I think is important in relationship to the Ending the HIV Epidemic Initiative in the United States. We saw some data from four African universal test and treat programs, the YATSE study, HPTN-071, or POPART, the SEARCH study, and the ANRS-12-249 treatment as prevention trial, that there is a direct relationship between the community viral load, those individuals who have viral non-suppression, and the HIV incidence in that particular community. We saw some data from Australia, New South Wales, that show as you reduce the number of individuals in the community with detectable viral loads from about 29% down to about 13%, you reduce the HIV incidence rate in that community from 0.88 new infections per 100 person years of observation down to 0.22, reduction by 75%. How can we improve upon community virologic suppression rates in the United States? In the U.S., one of our greatest challenge is linkage and retention in care. And we saw some data from Philadelphia that shows in individuals who are lost to care and then are randomized to either be contacted by their HIV providers or to receive outreach by the Philadelphia Department of Public Health, that individuals that had this outreach service, those individuals were more likely to be reengaged in care, retained in care, and experience virologic suppression. So active tracking and contact of individuals who are lost to care is really important if we want to end the epidemic in the United States. it may also be important that we provide more HIV care in the community. We saw a study that was done in Africa that looked at three different types of treatment scenarios. A clinic-based treatment scenario. Individuals were started on treatment in the clinic and were monitored in the clinic. Or a community scenario where individuals were started on treatment at home or on a van parked in the community and were monitored on the van. And then a hybrid scenario where individuals were started on treatment in the clinic and then were monitored on a mobile van. We saw that individuals that received care in their community were more likely to have virologic suppression than individuals that got their care in the clinic or in the hybrid scenario. And that was particularly important for the HIV-infected men who often don't, who are often not retained in care and often fail to maintain virologic suppression. And then finally, we saw an intervention in the community that looked at a way to try to improve HIV testing. And one way we can improve HIV testing and identify individuals with a higher probability of HIV infection is to test the partners of our HIV-infected individuals. In this study, they tracked over 53,000 individuals who were diagnosed with HIV. They were able to identify 49,000 partners of these individuals, most of whom could be notified. 19,000 partners were HIV tested, and more than 25%, 5,690, were newly identified as having HIV infection. 96% of them were linked successfully in care. There were very few cases of gender-based violence that were seen because partners had been referred into this testing program. So some of the key points in the HIV prevention messages from this study: we now have a second, more safe option for PrEP in the United States. The real-world experience demonstrates the effectiveness of PrEP in various community-based settings. The risk of developing resistance on PrEP if started when individuals have acute HIV infection is probably related to how long individuals are continued on PrEP before the acute HIV infection is diagnosed. An important reminder to do a viral load testing in individuals who have ongoing risk who you're starting on PrEP. A point of care urine tenofovir assay is in development that may help us monitor our patients' adherence. We have new products that are being developed for PrEP and PEP: oral products, vaginal inserts, and implantables, which we haven't discussed at this meeting, but which are in development and will be available hopefully in the future. An effective HIV vaccine remains an elusive goal. More studies are going on right now, and hopefully we'll see more success in the future. And then finally, ending the epidemic will require multiple strategies that improve testing, linkage and retention in care, virologic suppression rate, and identification of those individuals that need to be referred to HIV prevention services. Thank you very much for listening.
Hi, this is Dr. Paul Sachs, and I'm going to review notable studies in treatment-naive patients from CROI 2020 that took place this year virtually from Boston. Let me start with what I think is the most important naive study presented at the conference, and it was the IMPACT 2010 study. It compared three arms in pregnant women, newly diagnosed, treatment-naive, and the three arms were maternal dolutegravir plus FTC-TAF, or maternal dolutegravir FTC-TDF, or maternal efavirenz FTC-TDF, with the primary endpoints being viral suppression at the time of delivery, and the safety endpoint being adverse pregnancy or infant outcomes. Now, importantly, the women were allowed to be on ART for up to 14 days before entering the study, and most of them received during that point TDF, FTC, efavirenz. They were enrolled in 22 sites in 9 countries, predominantly in Africa. At baseline, the characteristics of the study subjects were well matched. They were generally quite healthy, even though they were newly diagnosed with HIV, with high CD4 cell counts in the 400s and relatively low viral loads, but much lower than we see in most treatment naive studies, because remember, they were allowed to be on ART for a period of time before entering the study, and they had actually were on ART for a median of 6 days before they entered. And the primary outcome of viral suppression at the time of delivery was statistically significantly better in the dolutegravir arms compared to the efavirenz arms, 97.5% versus 91.0%. In addition, as has been seen in other studies comparing integrase-based to NNRTI-based regimens, the dolutegravir arms had a faster time to viral suppression than the efavirenz arm. Let's shift now to the safety and see some potentially practice-changing results. And here, for any adverse pregnancy outcome, the best of the regimens was the dolutegravir plus FDC-TAF arm. We have very little data before this on the use of TAF-FDC in pregnancy, but these are extremely reassuring and very encouraging. This benefit of FDC-TAF in pregnancy was driven by a significantly lower rate of both preterm delivery and small for gestational age. Studies of pregnant women are unusual. It's always important to report on any of the transmissions that occurred during the course of the pregnancy. And there were two babies who were found to be HIV infected during the course of the study. One of the babies was in the dolutegravir plus FDC TAF arm with a maternal viral load of 58,000, indicating poor adherence. And the other baby was in the dolutegravir plus FDC TDF arm. And here the maternal viral load at the time of delivery was less than 40, but the which represents, therefore, likely in utero transmission. I want to mention the weight changes in the study because weight is being discussed so frequently in treatment-naive studies. Here, the dolutegravir plus FDC-TAF arm was associated with the greatest weight compared to the other two arms, but it was closest to actually the recommended weight gain for the second and third trimesters in pregnancy. So I think the take-home message from this study is that for women newly diagnosed with HIV during pregnancy, they really should be treated with dolutegravir-based regimens because of a faster time to viral suppression and also a higher viral suppression rate at pregnancy. In addition, FFDC looks like a very good option for TDF-FDC in pregnancy because it was the safest overall in the study with lower rates of preterm delivery and small for gestational age. I'm going to shift now and talk about a few other studies that were in treatment-naive patients. There was a study of acute HIV conducted in Thailand with 443 people enrolled prospectively, with 325 receiving efavirenz and then shifting to 90 who received dolutegravir. So this is over a time period from 2009 to 2019, reflecting a change in standard of care. And what the study showed was that the viral suppression was comparable between the efavirenz and dolutegravir strategies, but the CD4 cell count significantly favored the dolutegravir arm, with an increase of 205 cells at 12 months versus 286 cells at 12 months, highly statistically significant. Interestingly, the CNS outcomes between the two strategies were similar between the two arms, showing no significant difference, but both arms did improve substantially. One thing that comes up in clinical practice is the occurrence of blips or transient low-level viremia, and there's a lot of anecdotal thoughts about which regimens have more or less blips. It's kind of a study of blips. So what the investigators in this study did was they analyzed the occurrence of blips during the treatment-naive studies of bictegravir and dolutegravir. So bictegravir FDC-TAF compared with dolutegravir abacavir 3DC and dolutegravir plus FDC-TAF. And what the results demonstrated was no significant difference in the experience of blips between any of the regimens. It did appear that at week 144, the people who had blips were slightly more likely to ultimately experience virologic failure in the dolutegravir arms, but I wouldn't make too much of it. I think the take-home message here is that blips are relatively uncommon in both of these regimens and should not be taken very seriously. I'm going to shift now and talk about another controversial subject, which is low-level viremia and the question of whether it impacts survival. There were two conflicting studies on this, one from the NA Accord looking at nearly 20,000 individuals who experienced viral loads between 20 and 199 and comparing their outcomes to all viral loads less than 20. And the good news here for those who are agonizing over these low-level viral load results is that there was no difference in survival once the special analyses were done to account for baseline characteristics. I think this is reassuring to our patients who periodically do have detectable viral loads that if this is just an isolated occurrence, it probably means nothing. By contrast, this study from the Swedish HIV Registry looked at people from 1996 to 2017, nearly 7,000 individuals, and here they compared clinical outcomes in people with viral loads that were always undetectable versus those between 50 and 199 and those who were between 200 and 999. And what they demonstrated was that this low-level viremia at both of these stratum actually did have an increased risk of death. There were other factors associated with all-cause mortality, including higher age, male sex, lower CD4 cell counts, injection drug use, and treatment interruptions. I don't know that they could completely account for all these baseline differences, and as a result, I tend to favor the NA Accord study when it comes to this phenomenon of whether this low-level viremia actually impacts outcome. But nonetheless, the controversy will continue, and for now, though, I think what we should do with our patients with low-level viremia is continue to encourage good adherence and not necessarily recommend any specific change in treatment. So just shifting now to the Gemini studies, this is a treatment-naive study that's been presented previously. We look at this 96-week virologic failures called in this study confirmed virologic withdrawal with a focus on the people in the dolutegravir 3TC arm. And what the results really demonstrated was that even though there were 11 people who had confirmed virologic withdrawal in this study in the dolutegravir 3TC arm, first of all, none of them developed genotypic resistance. And second of all, the dominant reason why they had virologic failure was either treatment interruption or poor adherence. So this is not actually loss of virologic control, but more the person stopped their treatment, which probably explains why they did not develop any resistance. I also wanted to mention three studies very quickly on same-day antiretroviral therapy, one from South Africa, one from Rwanda, and one from Thailand. Probably the most important of these studies was a randomized clinical trial, which did show that same-day ART in South Africa was associated with both a faster time to starting ART, not surprisingly, and more people initiated within 7 days, but more importantly, a higher, significantly higher retention and care at 8 months after starting ART in the people who started the same day. While a Rwanda study did not demonstrate the benefit of immediate ART, this was actually a retrospective cohort analysis that may actually be confounded by baseline differences in those who did and those who did not start ART. And then just to mention, because it's such an extraordinary outcome, a study of same-day ART in Thailand showed that for over 3,000 people who started ART on the same day from 2017 to 2019, they had an extraordinary 96% retention rate and 94% suppression rate at 12 months, which I think is a world record. So to summarize, patients with acute HIV, dolutegravir and efavirenz-based regimens are comparable in viral suppression, but dolutegravir seems to get a better CD4 response. Bictegravir and dolutegravir regimens have the same incidence of blips. There is a low-level viremia. The clinical significance remains uncertain. I think that's probably the best way to summarize it. We didn't see any resistance at 96 weeks among virologic failures in the two-drug arm in dolutegravir 3TC or the three-drug arm of dolutegravir plus TDF-FTC. And the same-day start seems to be beneficial in some studies. It certainly is unlikely to be harmful. And thank you very much for listening.
This is Jose Arribas reporting on Virtual CROI 2020, and I'm going to give you the main messages about the data present on experienced patients. So we have seen two studies, important studies, of looking at the long-acting combination of cabotegravir and rilpivirine. We have seen first an update of the FLAIR study, look at what the news is that we've seen 2 years follow-up. Basically, it's a comparison of oral dolutegravir abacavir 3TC or cabotegravir and rilpivirine long-acting, given it every month intramuscularly. So the main result is that after 2 years of follow-up, long-acting cabotegravir and rilpivirine maintain non-inferiority compared to the potent oral combination of dolutegravir, abacavir, and 3TC. And the good news is that we have not seen more confirmed virologic failures from week 48 to week 96, and the number of confirmed virologic failures given it every month is small. After 2 years of follow-up, it's just 4 participants have confirmed virologic failure, compared with 4 in the dolutegravir, abacavir, and 3TC arm. There was a small number of participants who had treatment-emergent resistance, only 3 in the cabotegravir, rilpivirine, long-acting arm. And overall satisfaction was quite good with the long-acting formulation. So, but to me, the biggest news is that we've seen the results of the ATLAS-2M study. Here, instead of the long-acting cabotegravir and rilpivirine every month, we've seen for the first time results of this combination every 2 months. And that's, I think, for me, is important because it entails only 6 administrations a year, and that's actually quite convenient for many patients. So these patients came from the ATLAS phase 3 study in the group taking cabotegravir and rilpivirine long-acting every 4 weeks, or the standard of care arm, the oral arm of the ATLAS study. And the comparison is, as I mentioned, long-acting cabotegravir and rilpivirine every 4 weeks or every 8 weeks. And the good news is that the every 8 weeks group achieved non-inferiority compared to the every 4 weeks group with very high efficacy rates. So it's clear that giving cabotegravir and rilpivirine long-acting every 2 months can maintain virologic suppression. The cost is that there seems to be a slightly higher risk of confirmed virologic failure. Is 1.5%. It's very small, but it's slightly higher with every 2 months and every 4 months. That was just 0.4%. And it's still an analysis ongoing of why these patients fail, and it's in the presentation was clear that some of them have already archived resistance when they enter in the study with rilpivirine RAMs and integrase RAMs. But the good news is that for the majority of participants, you can give long-acting rilpivirine and cabotegravir every 2 months. We've also seen supportive data for the cabotegravir-rilpivirine oral combination in terms of its ability to maintain virologic suppression below 50 copies, but even less than that. We've seen data about target not detected in the SWORD study comparing cabotegravir-rilpivirine versus triple drug oral therapy, and actually there was no difference in the rates of target not detection between groups. And also an important theme in the conference has been how to manage patients who have historical resistance and are currently suppressed on a regimen, and how much you have to be worried about this archived resistance. We've seen the 2 years follow-up of the ARTPRO study, that is a pilot study that looking at 41 participants who have been switched to the dolutegravir 3TC, and approximately half of them had prior history of 184B. But to enter the trial, they needed to have a provital DNA genotyping showing that that did not show the presence of 184B. So half of them have historical 184B, but they were not present in provital DNA genotyping. The take-home message is that despite the switch to dolutegravir CTC, despite the fact that these participants had history of 184B, and also the investigators performed next-generation sequencing and they have minority populations with 184B, there has been not a single case of virologic failure after 2 years of follow-up, suggesting that dolutegravir CTC has to be might have activity despite the presence of historical 184b, but this is just pilot study. It shouldn't be done outside of clinical trials that probably are going to be performed looking at this strategy. And the other study that I found that was important is the BRAVE 2020 study, looking at the exclusively at African American participants that were virologically suppressed, taking two nucleosides and a third agent, and they were randomized to switch to BFTAF or stay on the baseline regimen. And this study is interesting because apart from focusing in a population that is underrepresented in clinical trials of antiretroviral therapy, African-American participants, it's also interesting because it allowed to enroll participants with prior history of NRTI resistance, not fully resistant, but having 184B or one or two TAMs were allowed. So the bottom line is that the participants who were switched to BFTAF did as well as those who stayed in the baseline regimen, and this occurred despite the fact that, as I mentioned, there was a proportion around 13% that have history of nucleoside resistance, most commonly 184B. So this supports that if there is not fully resistance to NRTIs, if a patient is virologically suppressed, the combination of BFTAF might work even in the presence of this partial resistance. And also we have seen an interesting sub-study of the TMB301 study with tibalizumab, the anti-CD4 monoclonal antibody, looking at efficacy results when in participants who have only one or two fully active agents. And the main message, this is a small sub-analysis with a small number of patients, is that ivalizumab given IV every 2 weeks can maintain biologic suppression up to 2 years of follow-up, especially if participants remain sensitive to a second-generation integrase inhibitor, such as dolutegravir, even in the presence only with one or two active regimens. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Graham Oyle from the Chelsea and Westminster Hospital in London, UK. I'm going to cover some aspects of adverse events during the course of the CROI virtual conference. The first things I wanted to do was dwell on aspects around weight, which has been an emergent concern after years of being concerned about wasting and then concerned about lipoatrophy. We're now getting into a world of concern around hypertrophy, where there appears to be a triangulation of influences of HIV per se, which we know infects adipose tissue at an early time point where there are immune cells present in the adipose tissue, the effects of antiretroviral therapy, and the effects of genes and environment that may be important to weight gain. So one place to try and look at what's happening with weight gain is in PrEP studies. In the past, we've seen in the IPREC study that randomized people to placebo or to TDF-FTC was that there was actually a small decline in weight in people who went on to TDF-FTC. When weight changes were looked at in the Discover PrEP study, what was observed was that there was greater amounts of weight gain in the groups randomized to TAF relative to TDF, each with FTC. The difference at the course of the end of 96 weeks was an increase of 1.7 kilograms with TAF versus an increase of 0.5 kilograms in with the TDF group. And then when this was evaluated in the subsets of individuals of black versus non-black subjects, again, there tended to be slightly greater weight gain in blacks versus non-blacks, although the differences between the groups in terms of the TAF black versus non-black or the TDF black versus non-black were definitely not statistically significant, and the same was true for the Latino group that was studied there, suggesting that per se the individual antiretrovirals are not having a particular effect over individuals, and that we can reassure our patients going on to either TDF or TAF FTC-based PrEP that they're unlikely to gain significant amounts of weight as a result of this. And of course, when we look at them, the interquartile ranges within those studies, there are wide variations reflecting some people gaining and some people losing weight over time. The study that really drew our attention to the issues around weight gain was the ADVANCE study, which compared efavirenz TDF-FTC with dolutegravir TDF-FTC with dolutegravir and TAF-FTC, and found greater amounts of weight gain with dolutegravir relative to efavirenz, each with the TDF backbone, and then further weight gain if TAF was included in the backbone relative to TDF. So there was some data looking at the metabolic consequences of that. In some cases, statistical significance but not clinically relevant differences were observed, for example, in terms of blood pressure or in terms of changes in cholesterol. And in some cases, those changes were least favorable in the TDF-FTC efavirenz arm, increases in glucose, increases in total cholesterol, because we know efavirenz can drive those events. In terms of emergent metabolic syndrome, where you have three of at least increased waist circumference, low HDL, increased triglycerides, elevated blood pressure, and a marker of glucose intolerance, only treatment emergent metabolic syndrome events were seen in the dolutegravir TAF FTC group, where they went from 5 to 8%, whereas there was no new treatment emergent metabolic syndrome diagnosed in either of the other groups, so that those differences were statistically significant, although the numbers were small. In terms of Framingham calculated cardiovascular risk, well, of course, over a 96-week follow-up, you're going to see a small increase in cardiovascular risk because the subjects are 2 years older. So all groups saw a small increase in calculated cardiovascular risk, but none of these were significantly different between groups during the course of that 96-week follow-up, reflecting the fact, in part, most likely, that the metabolic changes in the study are very modest, and the Framingham cardiovascular risk calculator doesn't include weight or waist circumference within it, so we're looking in the wrong place. There are also some data reported from the DAD study that supported the idea that changes in BMI during treatment were not apparently associated with increased cardiovascular risk. That same DAD study and these data from ADVANCE did, however, say that there may be some calculated increase in the risk of diabetes, so using a calculator called the Q-diabetes equation. Again, all groups saw a small increase in their calculated 10-year risk of developing diabetes. All of them remained very low rates, so in the 1 to 1.5% rate at the end of study. But what they saw is that the TAF FTC dolutegravir group had a significantly higher risk than the TDF FTC group. The TDF FTC, dolutegravir group, the TDF FTC efavirenz group had a higher risk than that TDF-FTC dolutegravir group, but the efavirenz TDF-FTC group had no significant differences for diabetes risk relative to the TAF-FTC DTG group. So again, weight not being the overarching influence over diabetes risk in that observation. What about other studies that were reported at the conference with regards to randomized data from weight gain? There were data from the BRAVE 2020 study, which switched patients who were all people of African origin, African Americans or Africans, over to bictegravir FTC TAF from their previously suppressive regimen, remembering that in this study the majority of subjects were already on a TAF-based regimen and the majority of subjects were already on a first-generation integrase regimen. But the changes in weight over 24 weeks were very reassuring, 0.9 kilograms in the switch group and 0.2 kilograms in the continuation group, which was not statistically significant. And the curves really from week 13 to 25 appeared to be remarkably flat in terms of weight change. So what about additional data predominantly coming from cohorts, some from randomized controlled trials, so part of the dolphin studies in Africa, looking at postpartum weight change when comparing dolutegravir with efavirenz, showed that the weight changes were greater, weight increases were greater with dolutegravir than efavirenz, consistent with multiple other comparisons of this pair. But interestingly, they had an HIV-negative control population here in this, in the Botswanan data that was presented, showing that the changes in the dolutegravir group were relatively more similar to the HIV-negative controls, whereas the efavirenz recipients tended to actually lose a bit of weight in the postpartum period, making them somewhat distinct from the dolutegravir and HIV-negative population. So it may not necessarily always be weight gain that we're observing. Sometimes it might be differences emerging through weight loss in one group. And then some cohort data. One study looking at the MAX cohort, showing that subjects who switched off a non-nucleoside to an integrase gained more weight, whereas patients who switched off a protease inhibitor to an integrase seemed to see relatively more stable weight over time. And in that non-nucleoside switch group, they saw substantial differences between the individual integrases used, more weight gain with dolutegravir than with raltegravir or elvitegravir. Unfortunately, these cohort studies at the moment are lacking data around bictegravir switch. The TRIO cohort, looking at nearly 400 subjects around the United States, also found a trend in switching off non-nucleoside to be a greater risk for the danger of gaining weight of at least 5% over 12 months. And they also found that subjects who had a low transaminase at baseline were protected against weight gain. One hypothesis there being that if you're already beginning to develop fatty liver disease, which may increase your transaminase levels, that may be a flag for the onset of metabolic disorders, particularly when you modify your treatment to something else. A study from Texas looking at 15 kilograms of weight gain over 1 year and looking at the interaction between choice of antiretroviral and ethnicity showed that the group that was least associated with that weight gain were individuals who were white subjects who did not switch over to a dolutegravir-containing regimen. The group that experienced that threefold more likely 15-kilogram weight gain were individuals who switched from were black individuals who switched to a dolutegravir-containing regimen, and that interaction for race was statistically significant. Studies looking at mechanisms, one study from Grace McComsky's group showing no differences in resting metabolic energy expenditure or calorie intake despite weight gains of up to 10 kilograms in subjects commencing antiretroviral treatment, and showing a mix of fat increase in both trunk and lean fat mass and limb fat mass, but also an increase in lean fat mass. We have to be cautious about lean mass because sometimes lean mass on a DEXA scan can be intramuscular fat, which is actually not very good for muscle function and may be one of the contributors to so-called sarcopenic obesity. And then data from the ADVANCE study looking at the efavirenz subgroup and the metabolism of efavirenz due to different polymorphisms of 2B6, showing that if you were a slow metabolizer of efavirenz, you actually lost weight when randomized to that group, whereas if you were a rapid metabolizer or an extensive metabolizer of efavirenz, you gained weight very similar to the dolutegravir group, again suggesting that there may be an impact of efavirenz on protection against weight gain, possibly through mitochondrial uncoupling rather than necessarily a direct impact of dolutegravir on causing weight gain. And then some Japanese data pointing to the idea that a resistin gene that's involved in insulin sensitivity was statistically associated with weight gain, along with other factors including low baseline weight at commencement of treatment, the presence of TAF in the regimen, and the protective effect of smoking within the regimen. And interestingly, that same resistant gene variant was also associated with a greater risk of psychiatric symptoms on the INSTIs rather relative to the protease inhibitors that were compared in the study. So that covers most of weight. Just one last thing from the islatravir development program is that they looked at the comparison of islatravir doravirine and during the first 6 months of treatment with 3TC versus doravirine 3TC tenofovir. And overall, the weight change in 48 weeks in that study were 3.8 kilograms in the islatravir arm and 3 kilograms in the doravirine arm, showing not much difference and probably just some protective effect by the presence of TDF. And that was also reflected in what was seen in terms of changes in lipids, where we know that TDF has a small lipid-lowering effect, but a more favorable effect on bone mineral density, again, because we know that TDF affects that unfavorably. In terms of other data, there were some data supporting the cost-effectiveness of off-patent statins for use in individuals with a five-year cardiovascular risk of more than 5%, and obviously we're seeing that being investigated in the REPRISE study, and we'll get more information on the effectiveness in that case of pitavastatin over time in the cost-effective analysis, because pitavastatin is still on patent. It was not seen as being cost-effective in those people with low to moderate cardiovascular risk. Obviously, the higher your cardiovascular risk, the more cost-effective your statin is going to be. Data around management of bone density, study showing that zoledronic acid was better than the removal of TDF at increasing bone mineral density over 2 years of follow-up. But when the DEXA scans were rerun using a different interpretation software called Trabecular Bone Score, they found that there was actually no difference between whether you simply switched away from TDF or received zoledronic acid on the small improvements in TBS that were observed, suggesting that maybe neither of those approaches is actually causing improved bone strength, or it's possibly that these individuals simply had quite solid bones at the time of entry to the study, so that they had a limited ability to actually see an improvement in bone mineral density. And then two studies, one from sub-study of REPRIEVE called PREPARE, and one from the HOPS study, first of all pointing to the high rates of comorbidity amongst aging subjects with HIV infection, with those things being a bit variant between men and women, more overweight and obesity in women, more dyslipidemia in men, more psychiatric problems, particularly depression in women, underlining that we really need to be trying to target multiple health interventions within our patients. And the PREPARE study really pointing to the idea that we actually have quite a lot of patients who are very physically inactive, 89% were described in that way, 37% having some physical impairment, so that on frailty or pre-frailty assessments in a population with an average age of 51, 6% were described as already being frail and 42% being pre-frail. Again, pointing to this idea of sarcopenic obesity, where you have a lack of muscle mass due to lack of physical activity, and you become increasingly physically impaired and essentially old before your time. So trying to target our patients to really get moving, to lose weight, to build muscle mass, to prepare for aging gracefully with HIV. Thank you for your attention.
So my name is Marta Boffito, and I work at Chelsea Westminster Hospital in London. I'm going to talk about the data on clinical pharmacology that were presented at CROI 2020 over the next few minutes. Interesting data were presented on the pharmacokinetics of new antiretroviral combinations that will be hopefully hopefully introduce in clinical practice over the next few years. And there is an extensive interest for long-acting antiretrovirals. Data were presented on long-acting neutralizing antibodies in both people without HIV and in patients living with HIV, and showing that neutralizing antibodies can be characterized by prolonged half-lives and be administered every 2 weeks. Data were also presented on new NRTIs, new tenofovir prodrugs, which are characterized by a prolonged intracellular half-life. Data on islatravir were presented as a dose of 0.75 milligrams will be brought forward in phase 3 studies in combinations with doravirine. And data were presented on the capsid inhibitor GS6207, which is studied for the treatment of HIV and has been shown to be potent in terms of viral load reduction. And when the drug is administered orally, there was no effect of food, and it is characterized by a prolonged half-life of 12 days. Interestingly, there were also data on what happens to long-acting cabotegravir and long-acting rilpivirin in people who stopped the intake of the long-acting dual combination. And obviously, after the intramuscular injections are stopped, the drugs are starting to decrease in terms of plasma concentrations, but can persist in the systemic circulation for 12 months after the last dose or more. What it is important for clinicians is to know that people who stop their intramuscular injections can switch back to oral antiretrovirals, and whether these are moderate inducers or inhibitors of cytochrome P450 3H4 or UGT1A1, they are safe to be administered to, again, patients who stop long-acting antiretrovirals. There were data on Tamsavir concentrations following the administration of Fostamsavir, and the concentrations were not remarkably affected by intake of strong cytochrome P450 3A4 inhibitors or moderate inducers, and the concentrations were not affected by intake with or without a meal, or by extreme body weights with low or high body weights, because the patients who took part into the study achieved a virological response independently from these characteristics. There were also data on drug-drug interactions. They presented data on concentrations of dolutegravir during co-administration with valproate, and while the total concentrations of dolutegravir are decreased, the unbound concentrations of dolutegravir are unchanged. So dolutegravir and valproate do interact in terms of having a drug-drug interaction at the level of protein binding, but the drug interactions is not clinically significant because there is enough dolutegravir, active dolutegravir there. There were very important data showing that trans women taking part into the DISCOVER study that looks at the efficacy of TAF-FTC versus TDF-FTC as PrEP do not show lower levels of either tenofovir diphosphate or emtricitabine triphosphate intracellularly for both arms, and the trans women that took part into the DISCOVER study were protected against HIV, so PrEP works in trans women. There were data about real-life management of drug-drug interactions between antiretrovirals and statins showing that high percentages of patients may not receive the right doses, the correct doses of statins, and may not achieve lipid control. So clinicians need to make sure that this happens. And finally, there were data on bictegravir concentrations in compartments such as the genital tract and rectum of males and females, or the CSF, and showing that bictegravir concentrations are above the IC50 also in compartment. Thank you very much.
Hi, this is Jürgen Rockstroh from the University of Bonn, Germany, and I'm delivering here a podcast from CROI 2020, featuring some of the highlights around hepatitis and HIV co-infection, which were presented at this conference. Now, the first thing to highlight is that there still are observations of large HIV outbreaks among people who inject drugs. So clearly, in vulnerable patient populations, in particular areas affected by the opioid crisis, there is a high risk. This particular outbreak in Carroll County, West Virginia, showed 82 new HIV infections, and clearly immediate interventions, diagnosing all people with HIV is important, treating people with HIV rapidly, and preventing new transmissions using PrEP and syringe programs appears to be essential. And there are obviously challenges along the way, in particular getting more people suppressed in this particular new patient group. Similar high rates of new incident HIV and hepatitis C infections were reported from a study in New Delhi, really highlighting that probably around 25% of people developed HIV, incident HIV and hepatitis C infection. There was a high rate of sharing syringes in the last 6 months. Three-quarters of patients were directly connected to at least one viremic person in their network, really highlighting how important successful suppression of viral replication in this closely linked group of patients is to prevent further transmission. There was also new studies on looking for hepatitis C prevalence in pregnant women, which, in the opioid crisis, in more young women having hepatitis C infection, the presumed transmission rate of 6%. This appears to be essential to screen babies. This group of researchers developed a new Luminex-based immunoassay as an effective way to generate a population-based estimate of hepatitis C burden among pregnant women, and found an overall 0.8% seroprevalence of hepatitis C in total New York State, which is, I think, high enough to warrant screening in this particular group of patients. And clearly, the low cost of this test makes this an attractive option to use more often in this context. With regard to the new infections, in particular in HIV-infected MSM, there were interesting analyses about what the drivers were of reinfections in this patient population. In some cohorts, like in Europe, over 25% of patients who were MSM with HIV developed a new hepatitis C reinfection within the first 2 years after clearing or being successfully treated for hepatitis C. In this particular analysis, it was really semen rectum which was associated with the highest hazard ratio for reinfection, so it still seems to be driven by risky sexual behavior, and that needs to be targeted by our behavioral interventions. Interestingly, data was also presented in the context of this outbreak of acute hepatitis C among MSM from Amsterdam, where previously a sharp reduction in new incident cases had been presented following increased uptake of DA therapy in this patient group, but now demonstrating that external introductions could complicate microelimination. So if you have neighboring countries which do not treat to the same extent, infections may occur more likely in the way people travel these days and meet at different sex events, which may have led to the clear increase in proportion of external reductions in that patient population from Amsterdam. There was also treatment data on acute hepatitis C. Previously, various studies have suggested potentially shorter treatment durations may be feasible in light of the high cost of DA therapy, this is obviously attractive. And this REACT study, which was NIH-funded and was performed in 8 countries, presented results from SoftVal, which was randomized for either 6 weeks or 12 weeks of treatment duration in patients with acute hepatitis C. The study was prematurely stopped by the DSMB because of a higher relapse rate in the shorter treatment duration. And indeed, at end of treatment, overall response rates were similar in the 10 to treat, 91%. Undetectable for hepatitis C, but eventually there were 9 relapses in the short treatment arm of 6 weeks versus 2 in the 12-week, and that then achieved statistical significant difference in the modified intent-to-treat analysis. Patients who did not, who did relapse were characterized by a particularly high baseline viral load, so clearly having a high viral load is probably the risk factor for breaking through in patients with shorter treatment cycles. So now guidelines only recommend the regular treatment durations, which in case of SoftVal would be 12 weeks. Then there was a registry study in co-infected individuals initiating lidivisir sofosbuvir in the those days when this drug became available. A lot of people were a little bit afraid of drug interactions, particularly with boosted PIs and tenofovir, and higher tenofovir exposure through drug interactions with lidivisir. Most interestingly, in this study, there was no higher rate of HIV treatment failure. Switches were most common patients on PR, TDF, and nephrotoxicity criteria were met in a high number of patients. But these events were independent of ARV switch, and so overall it looked as if switching or amending HIV therapy prior to DA therapy was safe and was not associated with any complications. And then there was an interesting work around NASH and HIV coming from a study which previously looked at the effect of tesmanrolin on liver fat and fibrosis, which was positively delaying fibrosis formation in patients who received the growth hormone, releasing hormone, versus the placebo-treated patients. Now, from that placebo part of the trial, liver biopsies were available from baseline and then 12 months later in 24 patients. So these paired biopsies allowed us to sort of address the question of fibrosis progression in HIV-associated NAFLD, which so far has really not been shown anywhere. And there was a surprisingly high rate of fibrosis progression of 0.2 plus minus 0.8 stages per year, which is much higher than what has been observed in the general population with NAFLD, which is only 0.03. Visceral adiposity was found to be a novel clinical predictor of accelerated hepatic disease, and that I think is important in the context of HIV-associated NAFLD, because that might indeed suggest that indeed the application of tesmarilin may be a way forward to treat that particular liver fat formation, and clearly more data will come in future trials around this subject. Thank you very much.
This concludes our audio podcast entitled Rapid Fire Review of CROI 2020, which has been brought to you from Boston, Massachusetts. This program was produced by the Postgraduate Institute for Medicine and Viral Ed, Inc. This coverage is not sanctioned by the conference organizers and is not an official part of the conference proceedings. To receive CME credit for completing this activity, please go to www.cmeuniversity.com, then click on Find Post-Test Evaluation by Course on the navigation menu, enter the CME code 15227, and complete the evaluation to receive your certificate. For more CME programming on CROI 2020, including an on-demand conference review internet symposium, please visit www.viraled.com. Thank you for your participation.